You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. You've probably heard us describe the latter half of the pandemic as a K-shaped recovery, a rapid bounce back to normal, economically speaking, for professionals who work from home, mostly kept their jobs, and probably saved money on commuting to boot. The other line in the K is the one that is flat. People who lost their income, got buried in debt, and even if they were lucky enough to find new work, didn't find the kind of work that could get them out of the debt. In a way, this was a speed up of what was already happening. Everything that could move online did move online. Small businesses folded left and right. The tech sector exploded. Amazon hired 425,000 people in 10 months, mostly at warehouse jobs, paying just over $15 an hour. It hired another 500,000 drivers through subcontractors, where it controls just about everything about their work, but isn't liable for their crashes. Amazon, as it happens, is the company through which our next guest set out to tell the story of the growing gaps in American life. Alec McGillis is a senior reporter at ProPublica. His new book is Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in One-Click America. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Why don't you start by telling us how you began this project? What got you on this path?
What got me on this path actually was not Amazon. For years now, I've wanted to write a book about growing regional disparities in America, the growing gaps between winner-take-all cities like San Francisco, Seattle, Boston, New York, DC, and some others, and then a much larger group of sort of left-behind cities and towns. We've always had gaps between richer and poorer places in this country, but those gaps have gotten a lot bigger, and they've had a very unhealthy effect on the country, on our politics, that they're not good for people really in either sets of cities, that the imbalance has just gotten so great. And so I've been wanting to write about that for years, and then after Trump got elected, I thought, you know, this is really having such a distorting effect on our politics. I need to write a book about this. And I decided to come at it through the frame of Amazon. And I chose that lens for two reasons. One is that the company is just so ubiquitous now, so present in so much of our life, that it's just a handy thread to take you around the country to kind of show you in a kind of metaphorical sense of what we're becoming as a society. But then it's more importantly, it's a useful frame because it itself helps to explain these growing disparities. The problem of regional inequality, of concentrations of wealth in certain places in our country, is very linked to the concentration of our economy in certain companies.
We do a lot of local coverage, so we see one end of this, which has been the steadily accelerating cost of housing here in the Bay Area because of the tech boom. Can you describe what you mean by regional inequality?
Sure. As I said, we've always had wealthier and poorer places in America, but the gaps have gotten bigger. So one handy way of understanding it is that back in 1980, there were only a few places in the country that had median income that was more than 20% above the average. Only, I think, Washington, D.C., a few other places on the coast had median income that was way above the norm. And then only parts of the Deep South and Appalachia had median incomes that were 20% below average or lower. Now, huge swaths of the country are at that lower extreme. Well, pretty much the entire Midwest, much of the Great Plains are now 20% below average in median income or lower. And then massive stretches of the coasts are now above average or higher. So you've just had this growing wealth and poverty at the extremes across our country, across the landscape. I saw this, I really started to see this as a reporter going around the country in the early Obama years during the 2008 campaign and the Great Recession, where I would be out in the Midwest or in Appalachia or elsewhere, and I would just be struck by just how struggling these cities and towns were, just how devastated they'd been by the Great Recession, how much they were reeling. And then you'd come back to Washington, D.C., where I was based at the Washington Post, and you just see this incredible prosperity on display. The D.C. area had barely been nicked by the Great Recession. And it wasn't just this prosperity that was on display. It was this absolute sense of complacency and sort of disconnect from what was happening out around the country. So you had the city that was, in a sense, making policy for the rest of America, but was just so disconnected by its sheer circumstance of that prosperity. That is sort of the heart of the problem.
So Amazon becomes an interesting case study Why? Because it's creating both high-paid jobs and low-paid jobs, but just locating them in different parts of the country?
Yes, that's one way of thinking about it. Or to put it even more simply, take the retail sector. You've had commerce and business activity and money that was just sort of spread everywhere in all across the country in all different forms. You had mom and pop shops and retail chains and department stores and regional department stores. And then, of course, a few behemoths like Walmart dispersed just about everywhere in the country and in different forms. And now, as we have shifted so much toward e-commerce, we have a single company that now controls more than 40% of all of e-commerce. And that e-commerce slice of the economy has, of course, boomed this past year. And so picture all that business activity, or a lot of it, that money, that commerce, just being kind of hoovered away from the rest of the country into the city where that company is based, Seattle. And you end up with just this incredible hyper-prosperity in Seattle and really kind of dystopian levels of wealth and inequality there, much as you've seen with other sectors. So take another sector, which is media. Media ad revenue used to be dispersed all around the country and flow to newspapers and local TV and radio. And now digital ad revenue is really the name of the game, as so much of media has shifted online. And that's really the bread and butter. We now have two companies, Google and Facebook, that control more than 60% of all digital ad revenue. So all that money, kind of commerce that used to be dispersed all around the country, now hoovered into the Bay Area where they're based. So that's what you're seeing, you know, in sector after sector. With Amazon, it has had this effect of creating, helping to spur the creation of these sort of winner-take-all cities where the headquarters jobs are located, not just Seattle, but now also Washington, D.C., that's going to get 25,000 high-paid jobs for Amazon's second headquarters, and then a whole bunch of other cities that have a lot of Amazon salaried, high-paid professional jobs, San Francisco, New York, Boston, Austin, even if they're not technically even quote headquarters for Amazon. And then you have, at the other end of the spectrum, basically what you could call the warehouse towns, the cities like Baltimore, one of the cities I focused on in the book and where I live, cities all across the Midwest, all across the country that are the warehouse towns where you do have quite a few jobs, but they're $15 an hour jobs, and they're also not strictly new jobs. They're of course jobs that have replaced countless brick and mortar retail jobs that have been wiped out as that commerce revenue has flowed to Seattle.
If I were to press a spokesperson for Amazon on this, and they don't give a lot of interviews, they would probably say something along the lines of our $15 an hour wage for warehouse jobs actually pays better than a lot of jobs at mom and pop shops do.
They do say that. That's one of the things they brought up when I spoke with them. And here's one way to think about that argument. The warehouse work has replaced a lot of brick and mortar retail jobs. In a sense, the warehouse worker has, you know, has replaced that retail salesperson at the mall or at the department store. And it's true that in some cases, that retail salesperson might have been making less than $15 an hour, though in other cases, they would be making more. A veteran clerk at a jewelry counter in a department store at the mall may well have been making more than that. In any case, the work of the warehouse worker that has replaced the retail salesperson is a very different kind of work. It has replaced it, but it's very different. It's much more physically taxing. It's much more socially isolating. It's an entirely different kind of work. And in a way, it actually more resembles the job of an assembly line worker in a factory in its sort of roteness and its physically demanding nature. But while it resembles that kind of work more, it does not pay nearly as well as that work does or did. Even after the decline in manufacturing, the average U.S. manufacturing wage is still about $30 an hour, so double what an Amazon warehouse worker starts at. So in a sense, we've created this new kind of work in vast numbers. You know, as you said, 400,000 more warehouse workers hired just last year at Amazon. We've created this new kind of work that is both more physically challenging and isolating than the retail job it's replaced, but also not paid as well, and also not as meaningful in a sense, as purposeful as the assembly line work. The assembly line worker, after all, is in fact making something, whereas the Amazon warehouse worker is simply picking and packing and moving things that were largely made halfway around the world.
I worry a little bit that we romanticize industrial jobs. In mid-20th century America, a lot of them paid very well. But that's like not how they started. In your recent writing about the failed unionization drive at Amazon's warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, you talked about the history of the steel industry in your hometown in Baltimore, Maryland, and pointed out it was 50 years before the steel plant at Sparrows Point was unionized.
Right. It's very important to keep the historical context in mind and not to romanticize. And the book includes a really kind of core chapter about the incredible transformation of this one peninsula outside Baltimore called Sparrows Point, and went from having the largest steel mill in the entire world to now being home to a logistics business park with now two Amazon warehouses. That chapter goes deep into the history of the steel mill and looks at just how dangerous that work was. And yes, early in the 20th century, the work was incredibly low paid, just crazy hours, crazy demands, absolutely at the behest of these plutocratic owners. But then over the course of the 20th century, they were able to unionize. So by 1941, they finally got unionized, pay increased dramatically, benefits improved. The work was still very strenuous and often dangerous, but even that improved because as workers got more say, they were able to also bring more safety to the job. What's happened now, it's almost been sort of a back to square one in the exact same piece of land on the very peninsula. We're now back to having workers who are not making as much as they're worth, who have very little say in the job, making an incredibly highly demanding job at the behest of their plutocratic owners and without unions. One big question going forward is, can we lift this new form of mass working class employment up to the level where it's something that's more sustainable, where someone could conceivably build a career out of it, raise a family on it, have sort of a middle-class existence, the way that the steel workers were able to starting in mid-century. The work itself is much more isolating in the warehouse. You're literally very often just on your own. You're at your spot on the conveyor belt. You're standing there. If you're a picker, you're just standing there by yourself waiting for the robots. Used to be the pickers had to, you know, roam the corridors looking for items. The way it works in most of the warehouses now is that they just stand in a fixed location and these robots zoom around with towers of shelves on them and they bring the tower to you as a particular item is needed. And you take the item out of the shelf, out of a drawer and drop it into the yellow tote, the yellow crate, and it zips down the conveyor belt. And then someone else standing by themselves is there to put it in a box and tape it up and all that. And there are other jobs across the floor like that. You're working alone. That's become even more the case this year because of the pandemic. They space people out more. So jobs that used to be done by two or three people are now done just by one. So the nature, the work itself is more isolating. I was speaking recently with one warehouse worker who I was talking about the fact that the steel mill workers used to, so often, of course, as you left a shift, you'd roll out with your coworkers and you just roll right over into one of the nearby bars or the diners for breakfast, depending what time of day it was. And the Amazon worker said, yes, there's no way that I'm going to go have a beer with Joe after work because I don't even know who Joe is. I mean, Joe might be working 50 feet from me, but I don't know who he is. So the work itself is more isolating. Then there's the fact that you're not yet unionized. So whatever kind of feeling of solidarity would come from that is lacking. But then finally, there's that feeling of the work itself, not having feeling of common purpose. Another former worker told me that there was just this sense he always felt when he was going to the mill as if he was going into a fire station with his fellow firefighters, that they all were at each other's back. You were going in together to put out that day's fires, except that they weren't putting out fires. They were running steel. Every day it's like, we're going to go in, we're running steel. How much steel are we going to make today for our company and for our country, essentially? You had that feeling of purpose. So he still lives down near the mill. That's now the warehouse. And he pointed out that every evening at shift changes, you can see people flying out of there on their own in their cars, the ones who have cars, just driving out at super high speeds, just desperate to get the hell out of there or get home. They've had to put in massive speed bumps there because people drive out so fast. And, you know, just that notion that this is a job, you want to do your job, you're making $15 an hour picking and packing these items, and you're probably not going to do this job more than a year. Turnover at the warehouses tends to be about 100% over a year. And that's that. You've done your time, you're going home. Much in the way that our own purchasing of these items has become, our role as consumers become much more isolated, much more socially atomized, the work itself has as well.
Your counterpoint to situations like the warehouse you were just describing in Baltimore is what you referred to earlier as winner-take-all cities. The cardinal example here is Seattle. And again, our reference point is the tech boom in the Bay Area. I think it's a little different. San Francisco's always been a center of finance. It has its own stock exchange. If you hopped into a time machine and emerged in 1970s Seattle, you wouldn't have been able to identify any foundation for the tech metropolis it's become.
No, you really would not. The only glimmer of it perhaps would have been the existence of a solid public university in the University of Washington, which as time went on became a real, you know, sort of breeding ground source for young tech talent. But no, the city at that point in the 70s just still very much had the feeling of it being a natural resource outpost, you know, a place that had grown up 1856, 1860s, 1870s as essentially sort of a source of timber for San Francisco. You had these sawmills there on the waterfront, Elliott Bay, Puget Sound, with the logs just kind of rolling down the hill after having been harvested all across the Northwest, and then ships taking them down to San Francisco to build that city. And you still had that sense in Seattle in the 1970s of it just being that kind of an outpost where you could just, you know, all the rail yards and the port, and just there's a certain kind of rawness still to the city. And the key moment is that starts to transform that is the simple fact that Bill Gates and Paul Allen decide to return home. They were from Seattle, had met in prep school there, and then had gone to Boston and then to Albuquerque to start Microsoft. And they were getting kind of tired of Albuquerque. They were having trouble getting people to come work in New Mexico at their young new company in the late 70s, and were also just kind of homesick for Seattle. And decided to go back there. And so they move Microsoft to Seattle. Microsoft grows by leaps and bounds in the 80s. And then when it comes time for Jeff Bezos in 1993 to decide where to put his new company that he has this vision for, he has zero connection to Seattle, but he chooses to set up shop there for two main reasons. One is for tax reasons. He knows one of his big advantages selling books online is going to be that he will not have to assess sales taxes on consumers the way that regular bookstores do. The way that the e-commerce taxes worked at the time was only if you had a physical presence somewhere would you have to assess taxes. So he wanted to stay out of California, not go to Silicon Valley, because that would have meant having to assess sales taxes on sales in the largest state in the country. So better to go to a smaller state like Washington State, where that's not as big a deal. And then the second reason he chooses Seattle is that Microsoft's already there, and some other tech firms that have kind of grown up around Microsoft. So he knows that there's a tech workforce there for him to draw on. That's really how so much of this regional inequality happens at the outset, is that you have this kind of winner-take-all effect where you want to be where the other tech talent is as an employer to be able to draw off of it. And then by the same token, if you're someone who's inclined that way as an employee, you want to go where a lot of those companies are so that if one doesn't work out, you can jump to the other. It's all about that human capital clustering. And so that's how he ends up in Seattle. Now, fast forward, and we're at the point where you have 45,000 Amazon headquarters employees in Seattle alone, thousands more across Lake Washington and Bellevue. And the company has just utterly transformed that city into something that, you know, would be unrecognizable in the 70s.
So this comes not just at the expense of companies Amazon has competed with and put out of business, but of people trying to keep up with rents inside Seattle.
Absolutely. So you end up with, you know, a city that is just now is dealing with all the various effects and costs of hyper-prosperity. And it's essentially second only to San Francisco in all these different metrics, whether it's increases in housing costs or homelessness or, other social indicators like very, very few families. It's second only to San Francisco in the low proportion of children in the local population. One facet that I focus on is the displacement of the city's Black community. Of course, something that San Francisco is also very familiar with. Seattle had a thriving Black neighborhood called the Central District that had grown up over the years. It was created largely through various forms of housing discrimination that essentially forced people into this part of town and developed over the years into this legendary one sense particular, and it's incredibly vibrant music scene, Quincy Jones and Ernestine Anderson and Jimi Hendrix, all these folks who came out of there, the central districts and these great clubs, after hours clubs. And that neighborhood really kind of burgeoned in World War II with all the workers coming from the South to work in Boeing and the shipyards. And in recent years, it has basically not stood a chance against the sort of wave of this hyper-prosperity. You go now to the Central District and you almost wonder if you're in the right place. It's very, very hard to identify it, recognize it as a historically Black neighborhood. Gentrification doesn't really suffice to describe what has happened to it. So I tell the story of that neighborhood in the book. Then on top of all those different transformations, you end up with, not just with, you know, things getting more expensive and more homogenous, but also with a really unpleasant effect on local politics. I describe in another chapter what happened when the city tried to pass a new tax on large employers to help pay for housing and homelessness services to deal with that crisis. And Amazon was able to kind of tap into a real kind of toxicity in the local politics in its attempt to defeat that tax and basically get a superficially, allegedly very liberal city to become very kind of anti-government minded when it came to addressing the housing and homelessness problem. And so, yes, this kind of inequality, these disparities have a very unfortunate effect on the winner cities too. It's not just the left behind places that suffer from it.
Yeah, that was a really interesting part of the book, because we think about the broad economic shifts you're chronicling as creating the opening for right-wing populist backlash for Trumpism in the heartland. And you spend some time on this in Dayton, where a lot of Amazon's cardboard boxes get manufactured today. But it's a different kind of backlash in those winner-take-all cities on the coasts where the wealth is being concentrated. There's just a certain coldness, callousness, a hostility to the well-being of the people who live there that aren't riding the same elevator up.
Exactly. And I get frustrated sometimes watching the debate in the winner cities about the housing affordability debate and its disconnect from the broader national context, the context of regional inequality. There's this vicious debate that happens in the winner cities within the left, essentially, between people who believe that the best way to deal with the housing issue is to expand supply, to dramatically expand supply by building more, take on the NIMBYs and take on the zoning restrictions and just build more supply and thereby reduce housing costs. And then the other camp, this I'm oversimplifying somewhat, but the other camp says, no, it's too hard to build more housing, too much resistance, or it'll diminish the character of our neighborhood, so on. So the better way to do it is just through regulation, through rent control of various sorts. So there's this nasty debate that goes on back and forth in cities like San Francisco and Boston and Seattle around this. And what's missed in that debate, that sort of intra-left debate, is that there wouldn't be nearly as much of a housing crisis, there wouldn't be nearly as much pressure on housing costs if there were not so much growth and prosperity concentrated in this handful of cities. And if the growth and prosperity were dispersed more around the country, it would alleviate some of that pressure on housing costs in these cities, and it would not be as acute a crisis. And so I just wish that people who worried about housing affordability in these cities would recognize that this is linked to the broader debate around antitrust, essentially, and make that connection. Instead, there's very often a sense that when I bring this up with people, and some folks in the winner cities, there's a sense that, well, we hate having such high housing costs, but we kind of like the fact that we have so much growth and prosperity concentrated in our city, A, because we are just sort of proud of our town, and we kind of think our city is the best. So of course people want to come here. Of course the money wants to come here. And it's often framed as a green argument that it's best for the world, for carbon emissions, if growth is concentrated in a dense green city like ours. What that overlooks, though, is that so many of the left-behind cities are themselves very dense cities. They are very densely designed, very densely constructed, and could themselves accommodate all sorts of very, you know, green growth. And so I wish that the connection were made more, that if you're really worried about housing affordability in your city and about people being displaced, then you should also worry about regional inequality and antitrust and the ways in which the things that are driving so much of the money just to be concentrated in a handful of places, because that's at bottom what's fueling this unaffordability.
That turn in the discourse you're describing often plays out as yeah, housing is really expensive here, and there's lots of visible homelessness. But, you know, this is better than the situation Detroit's in. But the counterexample is always Detroit circa 2021, not like Detroit in the 1960s.
Right. Exactly. And the fact is, if we just simply had more of a balance across the board, then Detroit 2021 would be in much better shape. It would be better for everyone. The example I think about that is sort of at the core of the book is the Washington Baltimore divide, which is so especially stark because they're only 40 miles apart and less than an hour by train. It's simply crazy if you think about it that you have in one city people struggling to afford row houses that now cost $700,000 or $800,000, if not more, and then just up the road, those exact same sorts of row houses, if not nicer ones, because Baltimore's architecture was sort of nicer back in the day, just the same kind of row houses are being demolished by the hundreds and thousands because there's such depopulation. And as the book describes, some of the actual bricks from the demolished row houses are being taken down to Washington and used to sort of create faux historical facades in condos. But that contrast between the unaffordability in the one city and then the other city just up the road, demolishing its own housing capacity, that suggests something that's deeply out of whack. It just doesn't make sense. There's something there that's very broken. The book really tries to get at that out of whackness, that out of kilterness.
Now, the way you're describing the out of whackness kind of implies that someone has made a choice to do something or to not do something that made it happen. The question I kept coming back to was, is this just the nature of the dominant industries we have now? Like, there's a lot of reasons that heavy industry likes to spread its supply chain out over a large geographic area. And you have one town in the Midwest that makes one type of auto parts and another that assembles the car. And, you know, a third that's just milling the steel that's going to go to the auto parts plant. Tech seems to naturally gravitate towards concentration.
Yes, exactly. And so here's how I think about this. There's a natural agglomerating effect to tech, as I described before, sort of the dynamic that made Bezos want to go to Seattle after Microsoft was already there. What has sort of exacerbated that natural agglomerating effect, clustering effect, is the fact that we have allowed the winner companies to get so big, the giants to get so big, so that the choices of any one company about where to go end up having these massively outsized effects. That's exactly what you've actually seen in Baltimore and Washington. The choice now by Amazon, and it was such an incredible example of kind of the winner take all, rich get richer dynamic, that Amazon would choose Washington, D.C., which was already the wealthiest metro area in the country, already super expensive, super congested, that they chose that place for these 25,000 new high-paid jobs and billions in investment, whole new corporate campus, instead of, say, Baltimore just up the road, where you would be able to get, you know, land, everything much more cheaply, that they made that choice. It was such a story of our times, and it's a story that exemplifies everything the book's about. On the one hand, yes, it was just Amazon wanting to go where the tech talent was. That was their publicly stated reason, that there's already a lot of those tech folks in DC because of all the sort of tech IT, security IT contractors there. But the fact that it's going to have such an outsized impact in Washington, it's only going to greatly exacerbate this terrible inequality between these two cities because Amazon is so huge. In a heartbeat, this one company is now going to be the biggest private sector employer in Washington, D.C. And then there's another interesting aspect to this, which is the reason that they're moving to Washington that is not stated publicly by the company is, of course, the fact that their biggest threat right now is not another company. It's not some rival corporation. Their biggest threat these days is the threat of federal intervention, of the government saying, you know, we've got to do something about these companies and somehow rein them in or break them up. So it makes absolute sense for the company to build this profile in Washington as a big employer, as just the big friendly employer that's employing a lot of your neighbors, in order to help to forestall any kind of intervention like that. So that's why I see this as being more than just a systemic thing. It's more than just, oh, well, this is just the way these things work. In this case, this one company, yes, it's true that we have all these structural forces in the country, and technology and globalization and all that are big things happening kind of relentlessly. But the company did make a very deliberate conscious choice. They do have agency, and they made a conscious choice to put this headquarters in Washington, not in Baltimore or St. Louis or Cleveland. And they did that for reasons that were partly just for the sort of, you know, agglomerating workforce quality reason, but also a very deliberate political kind of play.
Well, play counterfactual with me. Like, what would a different policy regime look like if there were more aggressive enforcement of antitrust and anti-monopoly bills, if there were some kind of industrial policy that tried to encourage tech investment distributing across a broader area? What kind of a country would we be living in today?
It would just be a country with somewhat more dispersed growth and prosperity. It would not be equalizing by any means. You'd still have some cities that would be fancier than others, more expensive than others. But you would have the hyper prosperous cities that now are just dealing with these kind of dystopian levels of inequality and high costs would be somewhat more affordable, somewhat less dystopian. And then cities like St. Louis and Baltimore and Cleveland and Detroit and others that now, if you go to them, they break your heart. Large swaths of these cities, they break your heart. They, you know, they break my heart. And some of them would be in somewhat better shape because some of them would perhaps be the headquarters of perhaps smaller companies that had sprung up in the wake of the breakup of one of the giants. I know I'm just, you know, throwing this out. If one Amazon becomes five Amazons, then that's perhaps four other cities that become a headquarters town for that that new company. It would be essentially reverse of what we've seen in recent decades, where a city like St. Louis that used to have all sorts of headquarters of major companies has now become a branch town because there was so much consolidation. All of their headquarters were essentially moved, lost to other cities, went to Chicago or New York or San Francisco or LA or what have you. So you just have somewhat of a dispersal, and it would not solve all problems or not necessarily bring back all cities. Doesn't mean that it wouldn't be worth embarking on, because we've gotten to the point now where things are so out of whack that even just some rebalancing would do a lot of good for the country.
Alec Michaelis, before we let you go, I want to ask a little bit about your process, because one of the striking things about this book was how you told the story of every city you write about through characters. And in Seattle, it's a veteran turned lawyer turned artist who is eventually displaced by rising rents. Also a participant in the Great Migration, who's part of the thriving Black community you just described and has to part ways with the city as well. In Dayton, Ohio, you find someone working on cardboard boxes for Amazon and basically trace back his family's economic fortunes to generations. Like, how do you find the people that drive your story?
It was a mix, but in general, I depend on just spending a lot of time in places, and I also depend on serendipity. I found that the young man in Ohio makes the cardboard boxes because I spent a lot of time in Dayton working on a documentary about Dayton. And along the way, I and the rest of the crew came upon him and his family, and I was struck by his story, and I stayed in touch with him and then brought him into the book. The steel worker in Baltimore who went to work at Amazon, I went to a meeting of retirees, steel mill retirees, and asked if anyone had a grandson or grandchild that was now working at Amazon, because I wanted to kind of chart the arc. And lo and behold, he comes up and says, "I work at Amazon." And I thought, wow, there's that amazing link. But then the artist you mentioned who had quit Seattle and went to St. Louis, I met him only because I was in St. Louis just last year working on an article about dollar stores and dollar store violence. And I was walking down the street one day in St. Louis and saw a gallery was opened, one of these sort of like, you know, pop-up galleries that tries to revitalize a dead block. And I went in and was purchasing a nice photo of St. Louis and started chatting with the person selling it. And it was this artist. And so I just, you know, in some cases I was kind of looking for someone of a certain certain sort to tell a certain kind of story. But in other cases, they were just people I'd met through all my reporting, and I knew that I wanted to have them in the book because they had such a powerful story to tell. And I knew that they were part of this larger story. Having real people was so important to me because I knew I wanted the book to be a narrative book and not an argument book. But I also wanted to just be able to essentially overwhelm readers with the reality of these various places and with the actual visceral details of what it's like to be that guy making the cardboard or to be the activist in Seattle fighting the housing fight or the small business owner in El Paso confronted with the Amazon coercion. And I just really, really in a very kind of human detail rich kind of way, just overwhelm you with these realities and get you to sort of understand things more on that kind of, on that visceral human level.
Well, Alec McGillis, count me among the overwhelmed. Thank you for the writing and thank you for talking to us about it.
Well, thank you. It was great.
Alec McGillis is a senior reporter at ProPublica, just out with a new book that uses the story of one company to tell the story of an entire country that seems to be coming apart at the seams. The book's called Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in One-Click America.